Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 283 of the Roguecast, recorded December 31st, 2019. Best movies of 2019. All right, we are back, and as you hear this, it is mid-January. As we recorded, it is the last day of 2019.
Yep.
So if the aliens have invaded or some weird plague has happened, we don't know about it.
Right. You may be wondering, why aren't they talking about what shelter to go to and what weapons are effective against our invaders?
Right.
We don't know that yet.
We don't know yet.
Yeah, no, so give us a break.
But probably it's the common cold. Or some kind of sonic weapon.
Water could also work.
Or water.
Water.
Or maybe just love.
I would give them an old-time drubbing, like a boxer from the late 1800s.
Yeah, yeah.
Put up your dukes against them.
Yeah.
See how they respond to that.
Yeah, try that.
You know, it did, he took a beating, but it did work in Mars Attacks, the big guy from Vegas.
True. True.
So consider Mars Attacks as your best as your best guide to it.
Or get an old iMac computer and hack their systems. Something. Anyway, that's a lot of advice for the aliens in case that happened.
But I guess the point is we're about to talk about movies.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about our best movies of 2019.
It's a pretty interesting, having seen all our lists now, I think it's a pretty interesting list of, like, some big budget stuff, some indie art house stuff, and like, a lot of things in between. None of us are, like, leaning super art house.
No. But Nick has the most outliers. He's got six that aren't on any of my or Dave's top ten list.
You're sicking me, Nick.
I've got four on my top ten that weren't on their lists, and Dave's got three, and then we got some consensus picks.
Yep.
So we're going to start with our three consensus picks, which...
These aren't going to be in a, like, super big order, right?
No. But by mathematical process of elimination, these are the best three movies of the year because we all like them.
Right. So if you haven't seen them, you will be forced to by law. You might as well go ahead and do it before the shock troops show
Honestly, if you haven't seen them, I'd be surprised.
Yeah. Are we getting into blockbuster territory?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think all of these did really well in the box office.
All right. Well, let's hit it.
So let's start with Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about Avengers Endgame, very specifically in all the details, but it's
Do people have opinions on it? Are there any memes out there?
I mean, I think so, but I don't know.
You know, here's the thing. I saw a lot of movies I really liked. I saw a lot of movies I really liked this year. But I put, when I was putting them in numerical order as best I could, Avengers Endgame took the top spot because I feel it's kind of a bit of a once-in-a-lifetime culmination of just... All the Marvel movies, everything they got right kind of came together.
Yeah, I agree. It's not that this is maybe as a standalone a better movie than my second or third pick.
Right.
It's just that, you don't get this kind of thing. It is a perfect capstone to a, like, 20-movie series.
Made me feel the emotions.
Yeah, and it definitely got me.
I was going to say that. And also, I mean, there are scenes in here that just give me goosebumps.
Well, and this is the thing I've been waiting for since I was 12 years old and never thought I was going to see.
Yeah,
like, having Cap say Avengers Assemble,
the moment with the hammer.
Yeah,
there's so much in
it. And
this.
It got off on the right foot for me with the not dialogue-less, but kind of wordless connection between Gamora and Tony Stark.
Yeah,
as he's about to
not
die
Gamora,
in the
Nebula.
Nebula, thank you. He's about to die in the ship, but he's made this connection with her.
They play paper football.
They put him on for a fall, she puts a blanket on him.
When she puts the blanket on him, that was when it hooked me. Right then, I was like, oh, I'm in.
Yep. And then when Captain Marvel showed up, I was like, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. The opening stuff is great. The time travel stuff is a ton of fun.
Yeah.
None of us expected the 5 years later.
No, that was
the
huge.
Weight of that.
And then that big battle that is the final third of the movie is just so satisfying.
Yep. It has all the best crowd pleaser type scenes in it, in a lot of ways.
Giant Ant-Man putting a smackdown on one of the big behemoths.
Yep.
And again, Captain Marvel downing their big cruiser.
Yep. Right. Taking a headbutt from Thanos like it's nothing.
Doesn't Thor throw his hammer at one point and Spidey webs it? That's a classic. That's right out of the comics.
Yep.
And also, I mean, you know. Thanos did not get punked out in that.
No,
though.
Thanos is vicious
when he's just
and
like,
mean. And...
When he's like wailing on Cap, doesn't he just like do some... Or no, his blade starts carving up his
he
shield.
He smashes up the shield, yeah.
And I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
and I always... I love the understated thing when... Of course, the portal scene. What is preceded? Wong says, like, you wanted more.
You wanted more.
What is he responding to?
Dr. Strange
is that
says
everybody?
That
Dr.
everybody.
Strange is that everybody.
Yeah.
And then Giant Man smashes up from underneath the... Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It did everything you wanted to do. It's a good finale. It reminded me a little bit, I mean, on a smaller scale, of what like Star Trek VI did, mm-hmm. saying goodbye to those characters and a lot. I mean, right. It's not something you see very often.
No. Right, and it had a big sacrifice that meant something after like 20 plus movies.
Yep.
I feel like there are legitimate quibbles with it. You can argue with how it kind of worked its time travel magic, or that it did time travel at all. And I'm like, come on, guys.
Yeah.
On some of those, I'm like, this is they weren't going to just let Thanos win, and there has to be some way to undo it.
Yeah.
I remember I had friends who were like, if there's time travel involved, I'm not gonna hate this movie.
And I remember like, that too, and I was like, well, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a comic book movie. Of course, it's gonna happen.
What was so
travel.
Cool is that they used the time travel in a way to bolster that sense of the legacy and the journey you, the viewer, have taken with them over the years. So in a way that I never would have quite guessed at as a thought to do it, this is why Kevin Feige does what he does, is like, it was also a grand tour of what you liked about the previous movies.
It was definitely not going to be a, if you haven't liked these movies, this is going to win you over. It is a, hey, this is for the fans.
It reminds you why everyone should like Thor Dark World.
Listen. They found some neat redemptive stuff in that, and that was pretty impressive. There was a great scene with Tony and his dad.
Yeah.
You got to see long-haired Michael Douglas in the 60s.
Fantastic.
And a fantastic final cameo from Stan Lee? Or was there one more?
Yeah, this was the last one.
Yeah, it wasn't like a great, like necessarily the outro cameo, like an ultimate outro one, but it was super fun.
Also, the resolution of the cat Peggy Carter, which started in the second Marvel movie, or the third Marvel movie.
That was what locked it in to me, for me, is that they sort of gave Cap his happy ending in it in a way that I didn't think they could do. It's the way, it's sort of a way that the films can do that the movies or the comics kind of can't.
Yeah.
Is the natural aging of the characters and the sense that there will be fewer of these than the thousands of comics, so they can kind of make their moments count a bit more.
Yeah.
So, and I thought it was really beautiful.
Yep. All right. Second on my list, second on our list, I think, is Knives Out.
Yeah.
Which.
The crowd pleaser, if you're not into superheroes, this is the crowd pleaser to beat.
Yeah.
And it's made, I forgot.
It's made a ton of money. We're definitely going to get some more Benoit Blanc mysteries
because
Ryan Johnson and Daniel Craig both said they were into it.
Yeah.
This is a...
It's a big murder mystery with a big cast.
Style, yeah.
Yeah, like just like they used to do back in the days with like Murder on the Orient Express.
What's interesting is that even having seen... Did you see the second... Did you see this twice? Or do you want to see it once?
I've seen it twice.
Nick, did you see it twice?
I've only seen it once, actually.
So I found it interesting. I saw it, I loved it, and then I went and saw it again, and I loved it just as much. Like, even knowing all the twists, you can enjoy it just as much. Like, it is not just great because of the twist. It is great because the acting and the performances.
I think enjoyed it more the second time. One, because my brain isn't always great at piecing together mystery stuff.
Yeah.
But that said, all the big stuff that happened on the first viewing, I was like able to take it all in. But there were so many neat things to watch the second time when you're watching red herrings and seeing characters connive and like kind of knowing the bigger picture. There's a particular methodology to how the one of the lead actress, I'm going to say, how she kind of has to lie. Without lying, sort of.
Yeah.
And it's great to watch, especially the second time. I was like, those are such carefully chosen words. I love it.
Yeah.
But this movie that has a lot of funny stuff in it.
Oh, it's hilarious. Yeah. Chris Evans gives a phenomenal performance. Chris Evans, man, he's not going to get nominated. Well, maybe he will for like best supporting, but that dude, his role as Cap in Avengers Endgame and his role here, that guy is great.
Well, he anchored the Marvel movies. He gave him the anchor that they needed, and a character that was like super wholesome and yet still beloved. That's super hard to do.
And that's the thing. He's the anchor here too in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's true.
There's a lot of people who are important, but him, Daniel Craig, and the lead actress whose name I don't remember are the anchors of this movie.
Daniel Craig steals the show for me. I love Chris Evans.
His ridiculous southern accent. He's like, I have eliminated no suspects.
Daniel Craig is still have the time of his life in this movie.
There's also, of course, great supporting cast from Don Johnson,
Toni Collette,
as a sort of hippy-dippy Gwyneth Paltrow, type.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Shannon.
All the family's backstabbing is delightful to watch.
Yep. Yes. It is.
And it's beautifully filmed.
Christopher Plummer?
Christopher Plummer. And he's also sort of the anchor because he, just as a very minor plot thing, he is a mystery author who's built up a fortune. He's got a family that's are many of them are conniving for it in one way, shape, or form. And when he dies under mysterious circumstances, no suspects have been eliminated. And so, yeah, we get the sort of follow-up in the next few days, and we find out what's going on. So just a great time. Everybody should go catch it in the theater if you haven't, or see it a second time.
And I guess we probably should have put a spoiler warning up front. We didn't give away anything too much on Knives Out.
I don't think we've given away anything.
But we are doing our movies at the end of the year, so we may spoil some stuff. I'll give the title of the movie before we get into it. You might want to jump ahead a few, like 5 or 10 minutes, in case you don't want to hear a particular movie, especially when we get into one that's a little more recent.
Right.
But third on the consensus picks list is Us.
Right. This is Jordan Peele's follow-up to Get Out.
Yeah.
Another sort of... really thoughtful and disturbing horror movie him.
What's interesting is I really loved this one, and when I first saw it, I thought maybe I liked it better than Get Out.
Mm-hmm.
With a little time, I think I've determined I like Get Out better. But it's interesting to see the conversation that erupted again around it, because I think some people decided that this is like a sophomore slump. Uh-huh. I think that's crazy, because I thought this was a great movie.
Yeah, I think consensus I've heard is that it is not as good as Get Out, and it might not be as good as it should have been.
People have problems when they start analyzing, like, well, how could there be all this underground stuff? Like, they start looking at it, and if you look at it too closely, yeah, it does kind of, like, it raises a lot of questions. But I don't think that's the point of the movie.
No. Well, right. It's like you're asking the wrong questions.
Yeah.
It's like going into, ultimately what I learned when I was watching Lost is that Lost was a series about journeys, and yes, while there needed to be some answers in there, like, tying it all up with a nice bow... is not really even what the show was about.
If your focus is, well, where did the polar bears come from? You're watching it wrong.
Exactly. And I prefer Get Out's sort of focus, and I feel that this was almost a little, I don't know if I want to say overly ambitious, or maybe even like mildly pretentious.
A little bit.
But like, it's such a fascinating ride.
And the performances, like, are amazing.
If movies that I find, like, say, it's mildly flawed were all this good, then I wouldn't mind any mildly flawed movie.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm the weird one at the table who actually likes this a little bit better than Get Out.
Yeah.
I think Lupita Nyong'o's performance here, as both leads, essentially.
Yeah, a protagonist and an antagonist. In a way, everybody got to...
The voice she comes up with for... Yeah.
Everybody just kind of gets to play, you know, for those who don't know, it's about sort of an African-American family who, when she was a little girl, the wife in the family had experienced a traumatic event in a funhouse, and we see that this sort of comes back to haunt them in a way that's strange way that has reverberations for all of them. There's these strange doubles of every one of them, it seems like. And it's a bigger scale thing than you think, where the reverberations almost have the vibe of a zombie plague.
Yeah.
Or that kind of, you know, those sort of horror movies where, like, oh, the whole world is threatened. But it's kind of, it percolates in the background. So, you kind of don't feel that way much of the movie.
Right.
But then when it happens, you're like, oh, it's what a fascinating way this is going.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does sort of speak to the larger issues at hand. And it includes elements as disparate as the 1980s campaign Hands Across America.
Yeah.
To goofy dad jokes from who's the guy who plays
Winston
the lead?
Duke.
Yeah, Winston Duke
is also fantastic in it. There are terrifying scenes in this.
Yeah.
There's like creepy home invasion elements.
Yeah.
It's unpredictable. You're like, where is this headed when you're watching it? It's super fascinating. It's also a movie that's worth talking about and kind of doing those deeper dives, reading some opinion pieces on it, diving into it with friends.
Yep.
It's cool to have a movie that kind of has that meat to it.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. You guys have one consensus pick, which I have not seen yet, and I want to.
Okay.
And that is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before, and we can, I think, talk about it without spoiling anything.
Never read the book.
Never read the book
series.
Right, series of short kind of twist-ending horror stories that I think it came out in the 70s and maybe 80s that was known for their ghoulish artwork. Really beautiful, horrific artwork that had lots of neat monster designs.
Yep.
And when I saw that Guillermo del Toro was producing it, and I know how he likes to do special effects monsters, he's great at it, but it's usually not my thing. So this was like way low on my radar.
Well, and I saw the trailer for it, and I do like Guillermo del Toro, and the director of this is somebody notable too. I forget. It's like
I have looked it up, and they have a few notable movies, but I forget what they are. I'm gonna have to.
But I was like, okay, that's really cool. I like those people. But when I went in to actually see it, I didn't realize it was a period piece.
Right. It is set in the 60s, and not just because it's interesting to do period pieces, but because like the sort of I feel like this is what they wanted was the fractiousness of the time. Kind of creates this anxiety that informs the whole thing. It even informs the backstory and everything they'll ultimately kind of discover as far as the mystery of it. And so there's like the Vietnam War is happening. There's elements of racial phobias and
there's draft
the civil rights movement, draft dodging. These come up in like important ways. And one of the lead characters is a Hispanic kid who like some scumbag early on calls him a wetback, and I was like, oh, this movie, I think it's PG-13, but there are times when it felt like it was like veering towards a little bit of R-rated drama in how they handled it.
It doesn't feel like surface level. There was thought put into this, and the characters are really fun, even though it was essentially a horror movie and you're fighting fighting monsters and things like that.
The kids are go on Halloween to a haunted house, and they're an interesting cast of sort of misfit kids that are misfits in a slightly different way than normal. They actually begin by like playing a prank on some bullies that I was like, oh my god, this is going to go terrible, but those bullies deserved it. And it has a little bit of that edge of Stephen King's stories like It or Christine, where you've got some kind of scary bully types. But they go into this haunted house, and it's known for a legend about this like woman, this ghostly woman who would tell children stories through the walls. There were these macabre stories, and it seems to kind of curse them and like kind of follow them out of the place. So these stories that were in the books, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, become inhabited as the characters experience them in certain ways. And they kind of like become aware that they're experiencing them. They know, and they're like try and avoid them, and there's what happens out of that is really fascinating. But I think that the lead actress was really good, and I sort of think of lead actor and actress, but it's a good ensemble. The special effects are great. The scares are interesting because I want to say it's a slightly low level. It's more eerie than scary. It's another one of those ones. It does have some scary stuff in it, but there's like a gross out horror sequence.
Yep. Wouldn't take your 6-year-old to see it, is all I'm saying.
No, not a good idea. I particularly loved the sequence within the hospital setting, which is like unnerving in a way that's just not like any other horror movie. Yeah. It is not a jump out and grab you unnerving. It is this slow sort of lumbering fear.
I'm really hoping they do a sequel.
Well, and you know, we talked a little bit in these last few podcasts about things that stick the ending. I loved how this ends.
It does.
It has an emotionally satisfying payoff for the main characters. It sets up a possible sequel in a way that had me energized for it. Like it just fired on all points for me. It was there's also not a lot of great all ages horror.
Right.
I always think of things like Something Wicked This Way Comes. There's certain horror movies like Poltergeist. Poltergeist would be another really good one.
Mm-hmm.
Like that could be maybe not great for kids also, but this one, because it has young protagonists, I think it's like particularly approachable. And yeah, it's PG-13, but you could probably watch this. Like a 10 or 11-year-old could watch it if they're up for a little bit of scariness.
Yeah, I usually gauge movies on how many times I've watched this. I've watched this movie several times. I bought it, and I think I've watched it over the Halloween and at least 2 or 3 more times.
I think I watched it a total of 3 or 4 times because I took different friends to go see it. I've got a lot of horror movie buddies, and I had a feeling that they would dig it. So, I think on my top 10 list, it was like number 2 or something like that because of how much I liked it. And in a weird way, it's not that you go see it and you're like, that was amazing. But it was like, the more I thought about it, the more I was like, it just worked on every count.
Yep, I agree.
What else we got, Randy?
All right, so let's talk about, Dave, yours and my consensus picks.
Yep.
Which I believe Nick has seen at least a couple of these and probably has some opinions, especially the last one. Let's talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Right.
Tarantino's latest. I know you and I are both big Tarantino fans.
Yep.
You've seen almost every one of his movies in the theater. I've seen almost every one of his movies in the theater.
Yep. There's always something, like they are good big screen viewing experiences because he's kind of a consummate filmmaker. I do know people, some people don't plug into his style, but if you do, you are going to get this satisfying and unpredictable experience almost every time.
It's funny because I know a lot of film nerd people. And I know a lot of cranky people.
Yep.
And those are the two people I find who most likely are like, not just I don't like him, but I hate Tarantino. And you know what?
Right.
I get it. If someone hates Tarantino, I'm like, I'm not going to be like, oh, no, what are you talking about? I get where someone, his stuff is all self-indulgent. He loves him, the N-word.
Yes. His foot fetishes are weird.
His foot fetish is weird. And he does crib from other movies. Like, that's the thing he does.
Right.
But if you like what he does, you're always going to have a fun time. And
every it's time like an elevated movie, sort of pulp.
Yeah. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a sort of slow, meandering. It's another one that's like probably could have used his original editor to go through and
take But you know what? I'm glad he didn't have it edited. I
like
think.
It too. I like the meandering nature of it. And
you know what do you call it? Kurt Busiek in a post I've reposted once or twice on Facebook when he was talking about The Hateful Eight, he talked about that meandering style and he said he's really good at bullshit, but it's purposeful bullshit.
Yeah,
like it has this humanizing effect.
Yeah,
but it kind of you get caught up in like that sort of hypnotic ways of it.
Yeah.
And this was, by the way, one that I, from the trailers, I was like, well, you know, the witty stuff in the trailers wasn't quite grabbing me. Not the world's biggest fan of either Brad Pitt or Leonardo DiCaprio, although I've seen them both do great stuff, but I'm not a huge fan. And so, and I wasn't sure I wanted to see a 60s Hollywood nostalgia piece that somehow intersected with the Manson murders.
I wasn't sure I wanted to either, but turns out I did.
It turns out I did.
And this is on a lot of people's top 10 list, if not, like, being in that top slot.
It's really good.
Well, you know what's fascinating is that it was still unpredictable.
Yeah,
I still didn't know where it was going. You know, what do you call it? DiCaprio plays a sort of a slightly on his way out action actor who's a little bit like a Steve McQueen who kind of like didn't hit those heights and looks like maybe he's never gonna and those questions are hanging over him. And his stuntman and best buddy is Brad Pitt.
And he has a pretty dark secret in his past that would make him... Both these guys could have easily been unlikable.
Right.
And like, they're both, like... Especially DiCaprio's guy could have been one of these, like, full-of-himself guys. But since he's so full of self-doubt...
Yeah.
He's very likable.
Right. You see him running lines with a... with, like, a old record player, you know, with the other lines in there. There's a very fascinating scene with a child actor.
Yeah.
There are indeed these strange pockets of suspense in it that have to do with the Manson stuff or Sharon Tate.
Yep.
And Margot
Robbie is Sharon Tate.
She's great. She's it's a very sort of, as a performance, it's not, you know, I think people have pointed out she doesn't get a ton of lines.
No.
But I think it is more about selling an idea and a feeling. And I don't think that was necessarily the an error on the film's part to film her scenes the way they did.
No, I think she works perfectly well in that role, and she's
infectious.
Shines in that part. Yeah,
yeah, I don't want to accidentally spoil anything more for you, Nick. But I will say that it's just, you know, watching those characters interact is what it's all about. You just go there, and just sit back, and just watch these people live their lives.
I will tell you, I will probably end up watching this on Sunday because my wife is traveling and she's just, for some reason, doesn't want to, even though she loves true crime, and I'm like, this has the Manson family in it, even though I know it's like a like make-believe version of the
sort of it's, everything's a little weirdly heightened.
Yeah.
Well, I will say it's not a true crime movie though. It is more of a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
But I'm in love with Tarantino.
When you see it, and if you like it, you may be able to say you'll know better whether she'll dig it or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've loved everything Tarantino's produced in one way or another.
Yeah.
I think I've seen everything multiple times except for Hateful Eight. I've only seen that once.
I have not seen Death Proof again.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen Death Proof again.
That one's a little baby movie, so I'm not going to count it.
Doesn't count.
I watched the extended version, and it was kind of sad.
Oh, yeah, I can see it. I rewatched Hateful Eight recently, and Indulgences and all, I had a great time.
Did you watch it on the Netflix? Where you?
I did not watch the biggie version. I just rewatched the movie itself.
I kind of want to watch
the biggie version. I want to watch the Netflix version, too.
Well, one of y'all do that and report back for me, because I'm going to, like, probably I need to show this movie to my brother at some point, and I would like to know what version would be most fun.
I feel like you still want to go with the original show first time.
Unless somehow y'all see like the extended thing and you find that it's like really it adds some layer.
Right. Alright, the next one is Spider-Man Far From Home, which is interesting because Dave, you and I were sort of the haters on Homecoming, like you more than me. But like I came around a little bit, but
largely because Homecoming, while I admired its like craftsmanship and vision, it felt like it was a very removed Spider-Man from my Spider-Man.
Same.
You know, Uncle Ben taken out, a much more sort of pop approach. Young Aunt May, Peter, who's a little bit more dweeby, Lego making than he is, like the studious, serious student.
Right, he wasn't the Peter Parker that we were used to.
Tony Stark really mapped onto him.
There was a lot more like his Avengers stuff kind of almost completely took the place of the Uncle Ben story. It's not that I wanted to see Uncle Ben again, by the way. No, I did not want to see a repeat of the origin for the umpteenth time. I just was unsure about those elements. And yet.
And so one of the things I think that changed between now and then is that we saw more of him in the context of the MCU.
Right.
And we saw him in... We'd only seen him in Civil War, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
But this was definitely a different... You know, now we saw him in Avengers Infinity War and Endgame. And we'd gotten a better sense of Tom Holland as this Spider-Man. And I think you and I both sort of made our peace with, okay, well, this is the Spider-Man in the MCU. Yep.
Well, we're talking about unpredictable stuff in Tarantino films. When I was watching this, at this, especially the second movie, I was like, Far From Home, I was like, I don't know where this is going.
Yeah.
I know, you know, this got Mysterio in it. There's other moving parts in it, including his relationship with MJ. And I was like, I can't quite tell what they're going to do. And that's fascinating because they're spinning some kind of wild possibilities.
Yeah, well, it sounds this big thing of, well, Mysterio's from another world and he's a hero and all this stuff. And we the viewer, were taken in as much as Pete was.
Right, which is a pretty impressive feat when everybody knows that Mysterio is a charlatan who tricks you.
Yeah, we should all have seen it coming.
Well, yeah, but I think a lot of people were like, well, in what way is he tricking us in this one? What's his plan? What's his end game? And what they managed to come up with was a method of like a villainy, I guess, that we hadn't seen him quite do before. That there were some dimensions to it that had never been done that were specific to the Marvel movies.
Yep, and plays nicely off of the Tony's legacy aspect, which makes sense given the way that Peter was involved in that.
Yep.
Also, the supporting cast stuff is so good.
The road trip and stuff is all great. Great. There's a great soundtrack to it. Zendaya?
Zendaya as MJ is fantastic.
She's great as the sort of, I'm going to say, slightly more gothy MJ who's like listening to true crime podcasts and stuff like that. It felt like it was much more finger on the pulse than MJ's been in a while in any film version.
The Ned and Liz stuff was hilarious.
Yes.
And the their Flash Thompson, who is just kind of a he's not a jockey bully. He's just kind of a rich douchebag.
He's a D-bag preppy guy.
And that's even better. Like, it fits so well in the time. That's one of the things that Spider-Man has done in the MCU is they have updated some of this stuff in a way that works. And I think...
Hey, give me your lunch money thug is just... Like it's not like that there aren't like those kind of guys in high school, but so many writers end up lensing them in really prosaic ways that I was happy ultimately to see a Flash Thompson who was a different kind of threat.
I agree.
We get more of Jon Favreau's Happy Hogan.
Yes. Which was always fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of spectacular stuff at the end, cool combat, and a few great surprises in the trailer.
I mean, the
credits.
The stingers are really good, and I'm so glad that we were going to get a third one because it felt like we were left hanging a little bit if we hadn't.
Yes, they had a very big reveal in it.
Let's talk about a movie that we have not had a chance to talk about yet because we've been on hiatusing and it just came out. And this is we're gonna maybe spoil some stuff, so if you haven't seen it, jump ahead a little bit. But the last consensus movie is Star Wars Rise of Skywalker.
Right.
Which, Dave, sits fairly high on your end list, I think.
Yeah, I have been, I think I've seen every Star Wars movie since the original one in 77. With the possible exception of that original one, I may have seen it in its 1979 release.
I'm
not 100% sure, but I've seen all the rest in the theater. Yeah. And I don't count myself as like the biggest Star Wars fan, but it absolutely has a grip on me.
Same.
And I kind of wanted to have... The one thing I was hopeful for is that J.J. Abrams would give me an emotional payoff that I liked, that I would like where all the pieces landed.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it. And I found that it had like an extra oomph, even with some criticisms, because it's... freaking Star Wars.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh man, you know, I saw the finale to Luke's story, to Leia's story, to all, like, I liked all the new characters. I like Poe and Finn and Rey and all those guys. And like, everybody kind of ended up in a place I liked. And so that was, kind of, in a way, like, if this were a normal movie review, I'd be like, add 3 points for sticking the landing for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I have my issues with it. I have pretty notable issues with it, actually.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who hate it, like, I can understand why people hate
it. Sure. I get some of the criticisms, especially if you particularly plugged into the previous one, which I liked, but actually I liked a lot, but didn't have the emotional component as much for me.
And so I thought this was a really fitting ending. I thought there's a lot of great action stuff. I liked the new characters. I always liked Poe and Finn and Rey, and I thought they did well by all of them.
Mm-hmm. I liked the opening. They actually kind of somewhat had me from the opening text crawl.
Yeah.
I liked the sort of wild boldness of the dead speak.
Yeah.
I heard akin to, well, I guess not really, but a lot of people are having the reaction to that opening crawl that we had to Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull with the gopher popping up.
Oh, really? Like, they were like,
they're like out, they were out from the crawl. Well, there because... was
definitely, I mean, we know people who, they were like, if the Emperor's back, I'm out.
Yeah, and I have felt that, like, no matter what, I'm actually a pretty big Kylo Ren fan from throughout the series, but I will say that as a villain, the fact that they, like, leaned so heavily into kind of his tantrums and stuff in it meant that as much as I found him an intriguing character, he was not the A-list villain that you needed to go out on.
Right.
And they, unless they were going to, like, quick create one for the last episode, there's only one person who hangs over the whole series, and that's the freaking Emperor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was happy to see him back. His massive legion of hooded cultists couldn't help but remind me of a certain modern-day cult.
I don't know what you think you're talking about.
I don't know. There are certain people who will, like, get into something no matter what crazy things a person will say. They just they follow his orders and edicts.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can determine what that is for yourself, but I'm just saying there were some satisfying moments at the end when things start exploding.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I liked all the characters.
Having Lando back was great.
Lando back was great. I kind of don't want to say one of the other surprises in there because it's almost too big.
There were a couple of big surprises.
But it was a big emotional payoff, and I liked that. I liked the direction that they found for Kylo Ren. I know that that's a little bit of a sticking point for some people. But again, I felt like I wanted a Star Wars that kind of made me feel hopeful.
Yeah.
And I needed, like, that Jedi ending, and, like, there were multiple levels on which this accomplished that.
Yeah.
Both for individual characters and that sense for the galaxy as a whole.
All right, that is the end of our consensus picks.
Everything else is a battle.
Everything else is, in some cases, stuff I haven't seen.
Yep.
So let's just jump back and forth. So, okay. Nick, on your list, I don't know if you want me to give you cues or if you want to just go.
No, you can give cues. That's okay. Fine.
So I've got Longshot on here.
Longshot is a weird one. It's a romantic comedy.
Uh-huh.
And it just...
I don't even remember this.
This is the Charlize Theron, Seth Rogen...
Okay.
It's directed by Jonathan Levine, who did, like, Warm Bodies and a few other...
Warm Bodies is a good movie.
Yeah. But this is about... Charlize Theron plays the Secretary of State. Seth Rogen plays a out-of-work political writer.
Mm-hmm.
And they grew up together. They live next door. She actually babysat him. They run into each other at a function. Actually, a function where Boyz II Men is playing. and they kind of rekindle a relationship. And it starts out as sort of she hires him to write speeches for her. So there's elements of movies like Speechless, but it's all lensed through just hysterical comedy.
Hmm.
And there's physical comedy.
I was a little worried it was just a movie about a schlub who got a hot girl.
No, it's physical comedy, it's relational comedy, it's just...
Who wrote the movie?
I can't remember. I'm sure Seth Rogen had some involvement.
Okay.
But it opens with Seth Rogen trying to... undermined the Nazis, like a group of Nazis that, like, are sort of rising up in New York City.
That sounds like a pretty good way to start.
Yeah, and goes from there, and it's funny. It's so funny.
I have mixed feelings on Seth Rogen. I pretty much like Charlize Theron and anything she takes a shot at.
Yeah, I did.
I'm open to the concepts I'm hearing.
I used to think Seth Rogen was a joke.
Yeah,
and I just never connected with him. But lately, most of his movies, I find some element as he gets a little bit older.
Uh-huh.
I mean, yeah, of course it's going to have drugs and there's going to be some stoner
humor.
There's a hilarious scene that has Charlize Theron and him taking Molly at a rave. And it is just, I don't think, I saw this in theaters with my wife, and I don't think I've laughed more than I did.
So it's interesting, Nick. I also, this didn't sound like mine, but yeah, you've totally sold me. This is going on my list of stuff I need to see. Also, the writers, Liz Hanna, who wrote, among other things, The Post.
Okay.
And episodes of Mindhunter.
Huh?
Yeah. And Dan Sterling, who worked on a variety of things, including the Kitchen Confidential TV show, Daily Show, and Girls.
Yeah. it's hysterical, and I don't want to oversell it, but
it's not the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Right?
Nick, is this one of those comedies that got a little bit of heart and drama in the at its center too? Okay. Yeah.
It's sort of all about standing up for what you really believe in, as opposed to doing what is on the surface. What
dig it. I also like movies where schlubs get the hot chick.
I think romantic comedies are dying.
Yeah,
and
a little bit.
This is one of those weird ones that kind of shine.
It's not on my top 10. It's not a theater movie, but the romantic comedy that is the one to beat this year is Always Be My Maybe.
Yeah,
that was on Netflix.
That was a really good one.
Yeah,
I really really liked that.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to jump to one of my picks.
Hit it.
Which is Captain Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
There were three Marvel movies this year, and I liked all of them. Captain Marvel was, of the three, was my lesser of the three. And I actually didn't like it that much. When I first saw it, I was like, it was okay.
You and I both warmed to it on second viewing.
But on later viewings, I came to really like it, especially seeing her role in Endgame.
Yeah.
And I really liked that character, and I can't wait to see more of what they do with her. And I loved a good period piece. The buddy comedy between her and Fury was great.
It's a structure we hadn't seen in any Marvel movie, right? That buddy stuff.
And I have a fondness for buddy movie, 80s or 90s buddy movies.
Yep.
Well, it was also like it was kind of testing out a technology to a level we had never seen before, which is young Samuel Jackson from the 1990s for the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah, I loved that was something I would want to say about it is I loved seeing sort of guard down Samuel Jackson Nick
Fury.
Before
he was quite so cynical.
Yeah, he is a hoot to watch. I love his interplay with her when they're just sitting down at the restaurant and stuff. Yeah.
Reminds me a little bit of like his character from Long Kiss Goodnight.
Yeah. Dave, you want to mention Dr. Sleep?
Dr. Sleep, yeah. This one kind of came and went at the box office. You know, it's interesting. I follow a few horror pages on Facebook, and somebody was doing, they were doing a, what's your, what's your best horror movie of 2019 on this one Facebook page. And for a movie that disappeared so quick, I was surprised. I felt like maybe a third or a fourth of the replies, which did not have a lot of consensus other than Midsommar.
No.
That Dr. Sleep was mentioned by so many people. I was like, I thought people did not like this movie. Dr. Sleep is, of course, a sequel to The Shining, but also brings elements of The Shining novel and the Stephen King novel that was itself a sequel to the big screen. But it's sort of a, for anybody who, if you were a Stephen King novel fan and you felt like, all right, what's it, Stanley Kubrick's Shining is a super fascinating piece of filmmaking, but does lose so much of the nuance about, like, people dealing with alcoholism and personal demons and stuff like that. Because, you know, Jack Nicholson is just freaking crazy right out
of the
bat in the movie. If you wanted something a little more nuanced, this kind of brings it to the movie. And in some ways, and yet weds it with the Kubrick's vision in a really fascinating way. It's directed by, I'm going to blank on the guy who did the Hill House.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he made Hill House. He already adapted Gerald's Game.
Yep.
And he has like even another horror movie, I think, in that mix. And I was like, oh, I guess I've liked everything he's done to some degree.
Yeah.
He's not perfect, but I like his vibe.
I can't believe I'm blanking on his name.
Do y'all got it yet?
No.
All right. Well, this is not a perfect movie. It has a little bit flawed.
Mike Flanagan.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah, okay. And he made Oculus, which I thought was a pretty good movie.
Yeah, that was a good solid horror movie.
Yeah, good kind of kickoff. Anyway, so in this one, though, the focus is on Danny, the little kid from The Shining. He's grown up. And it is not so much a full horror movie as almost a dark fantasy about... himself kind of trying to keep away from falling into his father's footsteps. He's going through alcoholism. He is haunted by the ghosts of the Overlook Hotel. And you will be characters revisit from that story, like Scatman Crothers' character as a sort of from the afterlife sort of visits. And that sounds real campy, but it's presented in this kind of both eerie and heartwarming way, as Stephen King sometimes does. He's played by, I'm going to blank on the actor, but an actor, oh God, he was the guy in Alias who was her, I think her.
Oh, is it Carl Lumley?
Carl Lumley.
Nice.
Does a great job as him. And I actually like all the characters that are flashback to, which includes Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall's characters from it, are just simply played by other actors who have a visual similarity, but they are not going for the kind of caricatured, this looks like it could be them.
I heard that, and I'd heard it was done, like, really well.
I thought so, but I have also talked to people who were like, oh, I wish they had CG'd him. For me, I was like, thank God they did not.
Right.
It would have taken me immediately out of the movie to see CG Jack Nicholson. As it was, they got an actor. I understood he was replaying him in these characters, these scenes. But essentially, without saying too much about the plot, there is a group of people that are kind of, they drink the like the life force of people who have The Shining, and they travel across in their own sort of dark family across America. And they have their eyes on Danny and some other people.
This is like the spider. This is like the Spider-Verse of the.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Inheritors.
Yeah, there is something to
that's that. Interesting.
There's some thoughtful, neat ideas. There's a few disturbing scenes, but it is not scary, make you jump horror. Almost never.
Yeah.
It is very character oriented. I found that I had tears in my eyes in one or two scenes, which I did not expect to happen in this movie. So it's a character driven, thoughtful, suspense. Dark fantasy story. It's another unpredictable one, and I suggest everybody see it, but don't go into it if your big complaint might be that didn't scare me, because that's not what this you're there for with this one. It's the same way that you might go to like have watched Hill House or whatever. Like watching the character story unfold should be paramount. Yeah,
that is what you're there for.
Yeah.
I
also love Ewan McGregor. So
Ewan McGregor is great in the lead role. He's a guy who can have some demons and you can still definitely feel for.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good supporting actors in it too.
Nick, why don't you talk about Midsommar?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack in Midsommar. But Ari Aster is an interesting guy. He did
Hereditary. He's gonna. There is zero doubt he is gonna be like almost the horror director to watch.
Yeah, and
along
I'll be,
with like Jordan Peele.
It'll be interesting to see what he does next. I don't know if he's announced it. I haven't heard. And I don't know if he will stay with horror or if he'll try to do something new.
Well, every one of his horror movies, of his two ones so far, zero in on very human relationships. Like Hereditary was about this fractious family.
Yeah.
And this is more about like relationships.
Yeah, this is about a relationship you probably shouldn't be in.
Right. It has been strung out. Over long, and there's been, I don't know if it's there's straight up gaslighting, but there's absolutely codependency.
Yeah, because it focuses on a woman played by Florence Pugh dealing with family problems is like putting it very lightly.
Right, she has had big time trauma.
Yeah.
And she's leaning on a boyfriend who is not up to the task.
And is not really wanting to be in the relationship anymore, but can't really quite break it to her because he knows she won't survive that.
Right.
And in some way.
And at the same time, there's also a certain element that is just sort of a certain cowardice.
Yeah, completely.
But it's a cowardice that I think anybody who's been in a relationship has experienced some version of.
Yeah. But it also hinges on a group of college students,
his buddies,
or grad students, basically doing a
they're like anthropologist types,
yeah, and wanting to do their thesis on things, and they're going to travel to one of the person's hometown, which is like this kind of small, like not hidden, but kind of hidden.
It's
place.
Like a small enclave community living kind of in old style,
like. Not
but also, like,
but
the friends
Amish.
Also think they're going to just go there and kind of smoke up and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's sort of part of it, too. But there is a... This is, like, by the way, the sort of that midnight sun type of thing where, like, daylight lasts 18 hours.
Yeah.
And there is a strange, eerie brightness to everything in this movie.
Yes, it is.
I mean, you know, like, on some sort
oppressive.
Of... On a metaphorical level, it's almost like the light of truth being shined on these people, like, if you want to look at it that way.
And Ari Aster kind of is very... meticulous in his design work of not only like the movie itself but like all like, the imagery and
I'm gonna say are they in like Sweden? I forget where it is.
I think
exactly.
It is. I forget where it is.
But
too.
It's like in the hills of Sweden in like it'd be like a encampment that has obviously cultish elements.
Yeah. But obviously you know things are not gonna go great when you get there, but it kind of unfolded in a way that I wasn't expecting.
Same here. It was disturbing in a way where I was thinking, if I was there, would I get out of there? Oh, that's interesting. You know, like, sometimes when the people who are in part of the sort of cult or group, they make some interesting an interesting case for their way of life.
I was gonna say, yeah, like,
and I know Aster. He said that he did not want to create a sort of straight up villains. He didn't want you to just judge them and say, oh, they're the bad guys.
Yeah, they do horrific things, but for them, they do it for a specific reason that they've all sort of been agreed upon. And you're like, so is that bad? And it's like you're questioning yourself. And that's sort of what it is. It's all about sort of...
It's unnerving throughout because it's asking you very difficult questions. And he likes to make, I think, the viewer squirm in ways that you don't normally do. It's not like a torture sequence or somebody is coming, you know, chasing you in a house with a knife. There's moral questions. There are traditional suspenseful elements. Like, it is a very suspenseful movie, too.
But it is horrific.
Yes.
I don't know if I can qualify this as being horror, straight up.
Yeah, it does. It reflects horror movies like, what was that one in the 60s? The folk horror one that everybody references that Nick Cage did the awful remake of?
Crap.
Wicker Man,
yeah.
Yeah, Wicker Man, which is itself a great movie. This is just as, like, Hereditary in some ways reflected Rosemary's Baby without being that close to it in plot points, but kind of having certain similar elements. This reflects The Wicker Man, which the original one is a great movie, and folks should check it out. So I'm still kind of turning it over in my head, Nick. I need to see it a second time, and I wasn't where you are on it, but I did like a lot about it, and I'll see anything this guy makes at this point.
Yeah. Also, Rennie, for fun, Chidi is in it, playing a completely despicable person.
I heard this.
from The Good Place.
Oh, interesting.
And, yeah, it's playing against type.
I think it's pretty clear horror fans should see it and see this kind of, like, just as they should see Us and see what the genre can do.
And if you have seen it, apparently, only on Apple, so if you've got an Apple TV or whatever, if you buy Midsommar, you get the director's cut, which is weird that you can't get it anywhere else, but I think it's like
I mean, eventually it'll be on Blu-ray.
Probably. And, you know. But it's like a 3.5-hour version, which sounds interesting.
So, Nick, you've got a bunch more than us on this, so I'm going to go ahead and have you do another one, which is Little Women.
Little Women. A revamp of the classic tale by Mary Louise Alcott. This one done by director Greta Gerwig, who did Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Lady Bird. My wife loved Lady Bird because it was very kind of a retelling of her upbringing in some ways.
Lady Bird is a remake of Lady Hawk, right?
Yes, of course.
Or a sequel.
I actually forget. Just very quickly tell me, what is Lady Bird actually about?
Lady Bird is about a teenager growing up with a very controlling mother and trying to sort of break free from social norms and things like that.
Got it.
There's elements of that in...
Wait, really? I actually thought it was about Lady Bird Johnson.
No.
Oh.
Not. No.
I totally thought it was a biopic about Lady Bird Johnson.
Yeah, I remember early on I did think that, but I knew that it was that did not prove to be the case.
No, it is not about Lady Bird Johnson.
It's not about Lady Bird Johnson. It is not a Lady Hawk sequel.
No. It's its own thing.
Got it.
I do recommend that one. I do recommend this Little Women. It's actually the best version of the story.
I've never seen any version, but I thought the trailers looked promising. Yeah. I want to see it before it leaves theaters.
Same.
Yeah, I mean,
Randy, let's put on our best gingham dresses and go see it together.
All right.
Saoirse Ronan does an amazing job as the lead, Joe.
Yep.
Cast,
I was already almost impressed just from the trailers.
Florence Pugh, who was in Midsommar, plays one of the other sisters.
Is Meryl Streep in this movie?
Meryl Streep is in it.
Like
Chris Cooper is in it.
Yeah.
But it's sort of the portrayal of themes that need to be told, like, that were there, but that are very... themes that women need to be have today.
Right.
I mean,
so this is set in what, 1800s?
Yeah, it's
early
1900s. 1893, okay. I think.
And so that is a question: is like, does it still feel relevant? Like, does it still feel like it has something to say, even though you would think we would be like, oh, well, this is like well over 100 years ago. Yes, it was probably important then, but is it still important 120 years later?
Completely, because it's sort of. All about breaking...
Same themes.
Breaking away from, like... Because at that point, women were basically property.
Yeah.
And it's how to live in that society or break free from that society.
I think we've had a lot of, like... And this has happened with race as well as gender. This sense that, like, oh, well, we've seen successful women. You know, women's liberation is done. Obama was president, our racial troubles are done.
Yeah.
This is clearly not the case,
no.
And we clearly still have a lot to learn, so...
Yeah, and really, it's, not only does it have those themes, it's just a good movie.
It's witty, I assume.
It's witty, it's funny, great. The camaraderie between the four sisters and the four actresses is just great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I've, the trailers for that have been winning me over. I've never read the book.
Now, I
know
tried.
A little bit about it, but I definitely want to catch this one in theaters.
It sounds like even among people who are like fans of multiple incarnations and are opinionated on it, there's a pretty close to universal consensus that this is a real good version.
And it does bring something new to the table. There's a open or basically like an opening and closer that's a little that wasn't in the book, but it is taking sort of Louisa May Alcott's words.
Oh, interesting.
So Greta Gerwig basically used some of her words, like in her other writings and things
like
that.
Okay, that's cool.
As to sort of bridge things.
I thought it was going to be bridged with like a Skynet sequence or something like that.
Yes, of course.
And John Connor going back to save the little women.
It is the future. There are giant women. They are telling the story of the little women that began. All right. My next pick is very different. It is Zombieland Double Tap.
Hey, that was a super fun movie.
I really enjoyed. So there were a lot of really good sequels. In fact, the last three on my list are all really good sequels.
Yep.
And I think Zombieland Double Tap. First of all, it's been like 20 years.
What's that?
It's been like 20 years.
No.
Maybe it's 10. It was a long time.
It has been a while. Long enough for them to have made a TV show that. Didn't happen, but
well,
was going to happen.
There was a pilot because it was based on a TV.
That's right. It was originally supposed to be.
2009. It's been 10 years.
Okay.
It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
So they go back and their younger characters have grown up a little bit.
There's like a relationship now between the younger not Michael Cera.
No, not Jesse Eisenberg.
Jesse Eisenberg.
He is Columbus.
Yeah.
And Wichita.
Right. They're together, but she is starting to feel caught up in it.
Yeah.
She has concerns about relationships. She doesn't want them to fall apart.
Right.
And so she's pushing against it. And it's, by the way, this starts out with like some of the funniest stuff.
Yeah, they just move into the White House and they just murder a bunch of zombies to get there.
Yep. There are callbacks to the excellent Bill Murray gag from the original one.
Yes, it's so great. Tallahassee has developed a sort of a father-daughter relationship sort of with... what are the other
Abigail Breslin's
Abigail character. Breslin's character, whose name I don't remember. It's another state or city.
There's also a great new character.
Oh, man, the new characters. The girl they bring in is one of those characters. She could be so annoying, but instead she's just lovable.
Yeah, she's arguably a sort of ditzy, clueless Barbie kind of type.
I adore
trying to
her.
Survive in this. But she will become endearing. She becomes endearing very quickly.
There's also a really fun bit with Thomas Middleditch. And I don't remember who the other guy is, but... they bring them in. Rosario Dawson is in it.
Yep.
Like, all the new characters are just as good as all the old characters. Their storyline of, like, trying to survive in the zombie apocalypse and the weird rules and the weird relations, it all works. Like, I love seeing this. I would be happy for them to revisit it again.
Yeah, I think, at least for me personally now, I didn't like Zombieland quite as well as everybody else did when it came out, but I did like it a lot.
Yeah.
I think I liked the sequel better, and that's pretty rare for me.
Yeah.
At the very least, I feel like it absolutely measured up.
Yeah.
And I'd be absolutely down for a third one.
Dave, you want to talk about Parasite?
Yeah, Parasite's a Korean movie from a director whose name I'm not going to be able to pronounce.
Bong Joon-ho.
Yeah, that guy. Who I know best from making the movie Snowpiercer. This actually has similar themes of class warfare in it. But it is, at its heart, a movie that starts out by following a poor family in, I think it's in South Korea, that is... They're kind of moochers in a way, in a kind of endearingly entertaining way, but they concoct a sort of scheme when one of them lucks into tutoring a girl who works for a wealthy family, and they start to get this notion of that maybe they can connive ways for the other rest of the family to get into this rich family's life and make some money off of them too.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from being this kind of like kind of delightful romp as you kind of like sort of see what you kind of enjoy watching their conniving happen, to watching things take some darker twists, and the movie is like it's mesmerizing. I was like so compelled watching this movie, and it's another one of those where is this going? Oh my gosh. I liked all the characters in it. I thought it was smart. I thought it was funny at times. Unpredictable, strange. It's kind of a little surreal. Mm-hmm. Not as surreal as Snowpiercer, I will say this. But because I think class warfare is like absolutely one of these sort of defining elements of our sort of modern life, I think that the movie has like a level of kind of like importance to it that most of these others don't, and yet it's an extremely entertaining.
I've seen several friends who put it on. I've been lucky. I've been sort of trying to zone out a little bit as you talk, Dave, because I don't know what this is about.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to go in a little blind, but so many of my friends have this, like, this is their best movie of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably best to know as little as possible and to just give it a shot. I think most people will be hooked pretty quickly on it and then just ride the ride.
Yeah. Nick?
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about The Farewell. It's another one that's on my list of stuff I need to see.
Dave is going to help me a little bit, because I know he liked it as well. Maybe didn't make your top 10.
Very good movie.
But this one kind of hit me a little harder than I was expecting it to. This is a movie starring Awkwafina. I don't know quite who directed it.
I don't remember either.
But it is
based on a true story.
It's based on a true story, which I did not know until the credits, where you actually get to see some of the original.
You didn't know that it was based on?
No, I didn't. Oh.
That was actually kind of what made it really like potent for me, because she's a kind of struggling young woman in like New York.
Yeah, she's in New York.
She's having trouble at college,
and her parents are in New York with her, and then she has a really close relationship with her grandmother,
who lives in
it's Japan? Korea or Japan or I'm blanking.
Yeah, I am too.
And that's horrible of me.
So The Farewell is a Chinese family.
Chinese family.
All right.
Written and directed by Lulu Wang.
Okay.
And basically, they find out that the grandmother is dying.
Yes.
But they,
the tradition,
in that tradition, they don't tell the grandmother that she's dying.
Like, a doctor has told all the rest of the family but her, because they want her to have like a good sort of last few months, and to not live in fear or whatever.
Which is crazy, and it's interesting to see how the different actors, I mean, how the family members sort of deal with that. Right. And
because they set up this sort of wild plan where they're going to stage a marriage between a young couple that they're kind of forcing together, to be honest.
A little bit.
And so that the family can get together and interact with the grandmother, but without telling her why they're there.
And they don't even want Awkwafina to go, because they don't think that she's going to blab. And in fact, Awkwafina just shows up, because she's like, I have to be here. I have to see my grandmother. And Awkwafina does an amazing job.
She's great.
And the woman who plays the grandmother, again, does an amazing job. And they have such a rapport with one another. It's just this very deeply affecting movie about family relationships.
Right. Including the hard stuff. Like, the frustrating elements. It is funny, and it's sad, and it's you can definitely feel yourself in her shoes. She's already kind of what would be a little bit of a black sheep of the family.
Yeah.
But the grandma kind of had always seemed accepting of her. And
but this
it's kind of heart-wrenching, because you know you're going into it kind of near the end of the grandmother's life. But there's some interesting stuff that happens, and I feel like you kind of need to see it. It's sad, but it's sad in maybe different ways than you might have guessed.
Yeah. And this, I feel, is just Awkwafina flexing a little bit of acting muscles in a way that...
Yeah, kind of going from larger-than-life characters like in Crazy Rich Asians...
And Ocean's 8.
To a really... She's actually a character who like has a lot of very internal scenes.
Yeah. So I'm very excited to see what this means for her and what else she's going to bring to the table down the line.
I saw a little featurette at the Draft House or wherever I saw it. About how the director cast her, and at the time they only knew her as like a hip hop artist, who did some like really raunchy songs. But somebody was like, I think she may have it in her. Crazy Rich Asians hadn't come out yet, none of that stuff. And so they show you a snippet of one of her videos, and it's something super dirty. But apparently she read the script, she like met with the director and talked about how she really identified with the character. Like, even like, I think she had a close relationship with her grandmother. She talked her way into the role and clearly was the right person.
Yeah.
She's going to be big in the next few years. She's already big.
I love Awkwafina and everything she's in.
Yeah.
Which brings me to my pick. And I feel like, I don't know, there's probably some metaphor for this, but you know, you have a bunch of people talking about things And they're talking about all this, like, high art, and someone comes like, yeah, but did you guys see Die Hard 2?
Right.
I feel like I'm that guy in this discussion, because all my picks...
I know what movie this is.
Nick's like, yeah, well, this is a movie about a dying grandmother and a different culture, and I'm
it's
like...
about women's rights.
Women's
and...
rights, and I'm like, oh, Awkwafina, I like her. She was in Jumanji, The Next Level. Which is totally, I'm going to be that guy, because I love Jumanji, The Next Level. I had so much fun in that movie. You guys saw Jumanji, the Welcome to the Jungle in the theater.
Yes.
And told me it was good, and I finally got around to seeing it, because I got Nick's digital copy.
Yep.
And I watched it, and I was like, oh, this is pretty fun. Yeah. And as I've watched it more and more, I'm like, oh, this is really good. I like what it does. And so when the sequel came out, I was like, okay, I want to see this in the theater. And I had an Alamo Pass, so I figured, yep, I'd go see it. And I went and saw it with my kid, because he wanted to see it. So I got to show it to him, and he really enjoyed it.
Yep.
And maybe that's part of it, is like, he really enjoyed it. He does not watch like a lot of movies.
Right, it's kind of cool to bring a kid into a movie that's that fun.
But I feel like they picked up really well with this. I thought they did a good job of evolving the characters and showing them having had this friendship, and now they're all in college and they're growing up, and one of them is sort of not quite still struggling, yeah, a little bit.
It actually was kind of weirdly realistic in the way, yeah, that can happen.
And then bringing in Danny DeVito and Danny Glover as sort of older characters who get dragged into, yeah, it with them.
I think people probably know the basic premise that these kids get pulled into a video game in the first one, and they end up in the avatars in this video game that's like a sort of Tomb Raider or Uncharted type of game.
Yeah.
They end up in people who are very unlike who they are in the real world, yeah, and there's just some heartwarming stuff, and there's a lot of super funny stuff. Well, this one brings in that, like, the kids are back, but also a couple of old folks are,
yeah,
in
so
there.
Danny DeVito and Danny Glover's character get pulled into it.
Danny DeVito ends up in The Rock.
In The Rock, which The Rock does so great playing older Danny DeVito, yeah, version of himself.
That the only other person who might do as good is...
Kevin Hart's actually better playing... We were wondering if Danny Glover was, like, on the set giving performances, because,
right,
it's so good.
He gets
it's
his
so
affectations
funny.
Down in yeah. such a precise way that it's fascinating.
Yeah. And they do a couple fun things. Not that, one of the things sequels can do when they do it right, and it's very rare sequels get things right, is that once you've established the rules of a world, you can start breaking them and playing around with them a little bit more.
Yeah, right.
So having them change characters a couple times...
yeah.
Having their abilities...
Essentially, it's like some sort of video game glitchy stuff.
Yeah. Having
stuff.
Their abilities and their weaknesses change, because they've, yep, been thrown into this new world again. Changing up the location so it's not forest, but it's desert. Mm-hmm. Or not jungle, but desert. And then they do the same sort of story. It's about, you know, Spencer and Martha and their relationship that, yep, was formed in the beginning. It's about... They bring back Bethany and Colin Hanks' character in a way that I thought was a really clever way to play off that relationship. Mm-hmm. And then the new relationship between Danny Glover and...
Danny DeVito.
And Danny DeVito is really yeah. interesting.
From the first Welcome to the Jungle movie, I've compared this and I was like, I don't want to say it's as good as Galaxy Quest, but it does some of the same things.
It's
which
in the ballpark.
It both spoofs its genres and has a lot of like slapsticky stuff. But it's also got sort of a heart and a love for its genre,
yeah,
and for its characters. And, like, if you haven't seen them, give Welcome to the Jungle a try, and then, yeah, I think...
It's a really fun action comedy. I thought it was a very worthy sequel.
Yep.
Does the NPC, what's his name?
Yes, Nigel Billingsley, played by, I can never remember the guy's name.
From Flight of the Conchords, yeah, and, yeah, a bunch of other Taika Waititi stuff.
Does he show back up?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yay!
Yeah, he's great. Dave, why don't you talk about Shadow, which is the last thing on your list?
Yeah, I'm gonna do this pretty quickly. This is a Chinese big one of those big period piece movies like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, that's filmed not quite in black and white, but it takes place in this sort of rain-swept feudal country, and it's like a fantasy of China in the same way that we have all our sort of Euro medieval fantasies. Of course, they have these the wuxia sort of style of sort of martial arts and movies. This one is actually a little more realistic in some ways, but it has like big stylizations. It is like never not raining in this movie.
Okay.
Everything has this gray tinge. The colors that do show up are so subtle as to almost not be there, so it almost feels like a black and white movie, but it's one of the most gorgeous movies I've ever seen in my life. And yet it also has amazing combat scenes, And it involves this guy also made House of Flying Daggers, another one that I really like in that genre. These big epic period pieces, and they're always very human stories at their heart. So in the same way that like superhero stories in America are kind of our way of, you know, we'll tell stories that hopefully have some depth and meaning,
yeah.
But the dressing, window dressing for them is these big dramatic fight sequences and stuff like that. Well, that's what these wirefu movies are in China, especially these big budget ones. And I found it a very compelling story that has, you know, something to say, you know, about war and forgiveness and, you know, these the ways you can't escape your fate. Actually, usually these stories, you know, I think the director also may have made Hero, and a lot of these ones are kind of have this noir-esque quality of, like, you cannot escape the sadness, and that is absolutely, like, a big component of this. But I hugely recommend it. You know, generally, you know, if you're gonna like these kind of movies, if you liked any of the other ones I've said, 100% catch this flick.
Nick, you got two more, and I got one more. So okay. why don't you hit your last two?
Okay,
and then I'll close this out on a dumb note.
So okay. I'm going to talk about The Two Popes, which okay. was a Netflix movie that they dropped right before Christmas.
Okay,
stars Anthony Hopkins and
God, I wanted to see this.
Why am I blanking on his name?
It's another huge actor.
He plays like Zartan in the G.I. Joe movies.
Oh, Jonathan.
Jonathan Pryce.
Right, he's also, of course, on Game of Thrones.
Well, of course. I mean, J.I. Joe is like the bottom of right. his
to me, good, movies. I'm not the only dumb one here. This is written by... Oh, no, I thought it was written by...
But this is about sort of the relationship that Pope Benedict and Pope Francis had, and basically about their lives previous to becoming popes, and... what happens when one of them gives up the papacy.
Yeah.
And it's just really, really interesting. Learning about sort of Pope Francis's background of being kind of, you know, dealing with regime changes, and I think he's come from Argentina, if that I'm not mistaken. Right. And, like, when, like, a warlord essentially took control of the country, mm-hmm. like, what he did, and, I mean... these are people, so they right. make mistakes, and he made a huge mistake that sort of, but there are elements that he sort of, Anthony Hopkins was very, like, straight-lined. He believed mm-hmm. in one thing and sort of very kind of what the Roman Catholic Church has always believed in.
Right.
Pope Francis was more about change.
Right.
And, like, yeah, he screwed up, and he's learned from that. He's deviated.
Right.
And he learned that, I mean, they don't deviate from, like, showing, like, you know, what the Catholic Church did with...
The child sex scandals?
The child sex scandals and yeah. things like that. And they talk about that, and it's interesting.
So this is told... this comes out through their conversations together?
A little bit, and also sort of when they elect the Pope and things yeah. like that. And sort of the, you know, people nominating them and... it's just...
everything I know about that I learned in the Da Vinci Code.
And the Da Vinci Code is not wrong in a lot of ways.
Right, I know they did do some research. The Illuminati stuff might be a little... have been crazy. Added, but otherwise...
but Anthony Hopkins does a great job, as always.
Yep.
And
those are two super A-list actors, you know, like...
oh, yeah.
They can anchor a project. They can be grand old men that know what's going on.
There's a scene where they're talking in kind of... one of the, like, rooms in the Vatican, eating pizza and drinking Fanta. and it's like, that's what Jonathan Pryce likes to eat. And he's, the Pope Benedict is like, but I like my, like, matzo ball soups. And he's like, and then he's like, oh, I love this pizza. I want this pizza all the time. And it's just small things.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of the overall picture that, yeah, the Pope is human too, and things right. like that. And, but also just realizing that, yeah, we can change.
Interesting.
And I think change is an important thing as a society, and it was nice to see, like, even somebody as big as the Pope can change.
That's interesting. Randy, whatever Randy's dumb guy pick is going to sound real dumb now.
Oh, my... No,
I saved myself, because I know what Nick's last pick is, and it's also a dumb
guy. Oh, my next pick is completely dumb.
Nick, is this on Netflix, by the way, the Pope one?
The Two Popes is on Netflix.
Okay, I'm going to try and catch it.
Definitely check it out. Do you want me to hit my
go
last
ahead, hit
one?
Your last.
Okay, dumb yeah. one. Yay! Let's do Crawl.
For a minute, I thought you said Kroll, and I got really excited. But let me tell you, I've also seen Crawl, and I really enjoyed it.
Crawl is a giant alligator versus humans.
Yep. They're trapped in a hurricane and, like, kind of largely in a basement. And there's not just one, but kind of multiple. Essentially, there was an alligator.
There was an alligator farm that got released because of the hurricane.
Yeah.
Stupid concept.
I should say it's not as stupid as say Sharknado. Like there are
not
alligators that are coming in the hurricane winds.
And these aren't like giant alligators. These are normal sized alligators. They are more ruthless and cunning than I would expect alligators to be. But they also play.
They don't quite do any like they don't cut the power like the aliens.
No, they don't. They don't cut power.
They're just
and they do act like. Like what the alligators do, right. They do like flip you up, and they
There's some scary scenes.
There are rules to what alligators do when they hunt.
Ten rules for dating an alligator.
And I was really surprised because it's all predicated on the relationship of father and a daughter. And the daughter is like a expert swimmer.
Right, but she's got to go back because there's like basically they're evacuating the coastline or whatever. And her dad, who's an older guy, is like, they haven't heard from him. And she's like, it's not quite bad yet. I could sneak past this police barricade and quick drive to his place and probably get him out. And things don't go as well as planned.
And the father's played by Barry Pepper, which I think does a really, really good job.
Yep.
Really tense movie.
Yep. It's, I think, Aja...
Yeah,
Alexander Aja or whatever.
Who basically did, he did The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah, he did the remake of that, and he did a movie that I always like to recommend that nobody else has seen called Mirror with Kiefer Sutherland. It's a decent, scary movie.
But the unique thing about him is he has a very unique way of, like, lensing things.
He does. He's a really interesting visual filmmaker.
And how he views, like, the alligator and sort of the cramped space they're in kind of just ratchets up the tension in a way that
it's
like,
a little bit of Die Hard in a basement if alligators were the terrorists.
Okay, I can't explain.
God, I hope that's the way they pitched that movie.
I can't pitch it any better than that. Watch the damn movie. It's good.
Yeah. All right. The last one for me is, I was surprised. It is Terminator Dark Fate.
Oh, yeah.
I actually thought this was a very good sequel. Nick, did you see this one?
I didn't get a chance.
So,
it hits digital soon.
My teenager is dying to see it and left theaters before we got a chance to see it because, spoiler, it turns out that there's not a lot of success in making a Terminator sequel. After you've flubbed it three times, people don't show up for number four. Even if it's good. And I can't blame anyone who didn't go see this. I only went and saw it because I had an Alamo Pass.
Yeah.
And then I saw it twice because I really liked it. This, it turns out the missing ingredient wasn't Arnie. It was Sarah Connor.
Right.
It was Linda Hamilton. Because they sort of reinvent this as a... They do a big thing in the opening credits, not the opening credits, but the very first cold open that changes everything about Sarah Connor, about John Connor, about what the Terminators are about.
Yeah, in kind of an interesting way.
And then they do this thing about a girl who maybe is the new Sarah Connor, like she's the one who's going to give birth to the Savior, and the Terminator's haunting her, and the Terminator is an evolution of. It's the liquid metal over an endoskeleton, so you get both Terminators in one.
Right.
He's got more personality. Mm-hmm. He's able to mimic people more effectively as a person, which is interesting. And then instead of Terminator sent back, there is a female enhanced soldier who's got sort of cybernetic aspects. And there's
almost like a Lazarus unit in the Greg Rucka.
Yeah,
stuff
yeah.
Like a really tough to kill normal person with cybernetics.
But there's some interesting twists to that too.
Yeah.
And then there is also Linda Hamilton shows up because she's been hunting Terminators, and that's all in the trailers. But there's the way they bring all that about, and the way they show like why Arnold's character shows back up, what Linda Hamilton's been up to.
Yeah, like why is she hunting like multiple Terminators?
Yeah.
How did she get good at it? What does she even do to stop them?
It's really good. It's really good world building, and I thought the character stuff was good. The character arcs are really good. They tie it a little bit in the same way that Terminator 2 was all about sort of like, maybe don't trust the cops.
Yeah.
This is maybe don't trust the INS.
Right.
There's some good social commentary in there. It's a really good, if this was Terminator 3, we might have gotten Terminator 4 and 5 and 6 and all that without a bunch of crap.
Right, with a higher quality.
Yeah.
Randy, let me ask you, do you think they should like leave well enough alone, or should we go ahead and get another one?
You know what? If they could do another one, I think they should, because now they seem to have cracked
the code.
What might make it work as a sequel.
Right, as long as they know what the code was.
Well, but you don't have to do, it doesn't have to be another remake of what's the Sarah Connor story. You can go bigger than that.
Right.
And I don't think they will. For the one thing, that it did so terribly in theaters.
The box office reports were just awful.
It was dismal.
Yeah, well, yeah. I've liked, Dr. Sleep did poorly at the box office. I've liked some movies that didn't do well this year.
Yeah.
And, lots of, certainly movies have come out that have been good movies, like John Carpenter's The Thing and other stuff like that, have bombed at the box office only to find an audience and become hugely respected later.
I think, all the Netflix and Amazon and all this stuff are getting people to think, like, our movie's dying. Just in theaters.
Right.
Like, is that a thing of the past? Are we trying to hold on to theaters?
That's a downer note to end on.
I know, I'm sorry.
But here's the thing. I think people have been saying that. It's just what they've been saying. Comics are dying for 50 years.
Exactly. Right.
And the truth is really that they're evolving.
Yeah.
And that we just, like, sometimes the evolution doesn't look like what we grew up with, and it freaks us out a bit.
Yeah.
Including me.
All right. Well, hopefully all enjoyed our take on, there was no comics content this week other than us talking about Avengers Endgame.
That's true.
Well, this is the other stuff on our pop cultural radar, which includes movies.
Right, and we talked about superhero stuff, which are comic-based characters.
Yeah, and I talked about a whole bunch of dumb stuff.
Anyway, if you've seen any movies at all in your life, please send us an email saying, I have seen a movie, in the subject line.
We're getting a lot of emails.
I bet it's going to be one.
All right. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back. Hopefully, I think next week we should be back with regular podcasts. If I've worked out the timing and all this correct. If not, we'll have a week or maybe two off as we wait for Anna to return from the frozen tundra.
Yes.
And until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.